What do you think about socialized healthcare?
I do not like the idea of that.
I don't want the government picking what I can and cannot do.
Well, my husband's from Europe, so I think it's pretty good, actually. I think a lot of people are covered by it. Everybody's covered. They don't have to worry about paying for it.
It's definitely more accessible for everybody. It allows all of us to remain healthy, to live long lives as much as we can.
I think it's kind of a necessity that the government provides health care for its citizens.
If everybody has something for free, who's going to pay for it? Well, that's going to increase. You like to pay taxes?
Krista, when
Very
he
quickly,
says,
then I want to talk
when
about
he says public
on
option,
Capitol Hill.
He's talking about socialized medicine and when he and health care.
Obviously, in the United States of America, we have a new president who has been inaugurated. But one of the main concerns that has been spread is that we could be under potentially a socialist society when it comes to healthcare, universal healthcare. But what you may not realize is that America is the only rich country actually without universal healthcare. While Americans have such a deep fear of the progression towards healthcare for all, I thought that maybe, just maybe, we should dive into the reality of not what we hear, but to find out from the source and from people who live and they navigate and they work in healthcare, that their whole construct is based on socialized medicine. So I want you to enjoy this episode as much as I love talking to them. They have a phenomenal podcast, which is called the Gritty Nurse Podcast. They are two RNs that they actually work and they live and they understand what socialized medicine really means and their perception on the way that the United States deals with those situations of high-risk population. It's comforting in a sense. So I hope you enjoy this episode of First, Do No Harm. As you know, I'm sure that we have a new president. So one of the things that I feel like our entire country of the United States, we're freaking out about the potential of healthcare. Like Bernie Sanders was kind of a scare to people who were Trump supporters because we can't wrap our heads around the benefits of more of a universal healthcare. So I thought instead of just telling people what it's like, I would go directly to the source and dive in from people who get to see it firsthand. Before we really get started about it, I would love if you two would give the information, introduce yourselves, introduce your awesome podcast that I love, and where people can find you.
Amy, you want to go first?
So my name is of the Gritty Nurse Podcast, as well as Gritty Nurse Apparel. I'm a nurse, advanced practice nurse. I did my specialty in women's health, also some transgender medicine, background in nursing, labor and delivery, obstetrics, also was an educator, so, and a professional practice clinician in all areas, maternal child, have done some teaching, university and college, now working in quality and risk, overseeing emergency departments and infection control, and I just got handed ambulatory clinics, so that's tons of fun.
Wow, Amy. Wow. That's incredible.
That's me in a nutshell.
So I'm Sarah. I'm the other co-host of the Gritty Nurse Podcast. And my background is mainly in labor and delivery, postpartum, NICU. So I worked as a bedside nurse for 8 years. I've also done some prenatal education. I worked in research for a bit, worked as an advanced practice nurse in maternal child. And right now I work in community care. So definitely we have a lot of experience and we started this podcast just about a year ago, and really it was just to highlight a lot of the issues that nurses face, in particular bullying, nurse-on-nurse violence, and now it's sort of evolved to like a lifestyle, and we really just want to talk about hot topics, so things that really matter to nurses and in general the healthcare world.
Awesome. Where can people find your podcast and your Instagram and all that good stuff?
Mm-hmm. So you can find us on most major podcast listening platforms, so Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, iHeartRadio. We've got a YouTube channel. We also, if you look up Gritty Nurse Podcast, you can find us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter.
Okay, very cool. Where do you guys reside?
Amy and I live in Ontario, so I'm actually based in Toronto, and Amy's just outside of Toronto.
Awesome.
Yeah, I would say we're just in the GTA. That's okay. Kind of, yeah. The greater Toronto area.
I have some questions for you. First of all, can you explain your type of healthcare as far as insurance goes?
You know, it's funny that you say that Americans can't wrap their heads around universal healthcare. I have a hard time wrapping my head around the fact that you have to pay for everything. So I guess the way that I would explain healthcare to you is it's essentially worry-free in terms of finances. So you have a doctor's appointment, or you have to go to the emergency, or you have surgery, or you need to see a specialist. That is all covered. So regardless of your income or whether or not you're working, as long as you have what we call an Ontario health insurance plan, or you're a refugee and you've got refugee status, all of this is covered. So I think I just look at it in terms of there's no payment really involved in terms of seeking healthcare. You can go to any hospital geographically where you want. You're not tied to whatever hospital network your insurance is associated with. So I think in terms of that, it's just a lot more simplified and it's a lot more accessible.
For hospitals and doctors, the payment is covered, right? But it doesn't cover the dental, vision, care, right, prescription meds. So is that when you would seek additional insurance, do you get to have additional insurance to cover those costs?
Yeah, so I guess in her, it's not perfect. So it doesn't cover everything. And you're right, it doesn't cover dental care. So there are exceptions to this where if you're under 18, usually dental care is covered, or if you have a high risk condition, in some cases it would be covered. But you're right, it actually really depends on whether you have employment that has insurance that would cover a dental, you know, preventative and procedures and that kind of thing. And also, medications are only covered if you're an inpatient in the hospital. So let's say you've gone to your doctor and you're prescribed a medication. In most cases, you do need to pay out of pocket. Again, there are exceptions if you are elderly or you're, I'm trying to think of other situations, but there are some situations where you would be covered, but in most other cases, you would have to pay for your medications. And even things like getting a massage, going to see a chiropractor, like those sort of allied health professions would not be covered under our health system. And in particular, also I want to mention that most mental health services are not covered. So if you're trying to seek counseling or that kind of thing, it's usually not covered. If you are lucky enough to get into a psychiatrist, usually that's several months' wait. That would be covered, but most other mental health services are not covered.
Just kind of jumping on that aspect with Sarah in terms of the mental health services. So again, we do have, I guess, the detriment or downside to our system is that wait time, right? Because there are people in queue and we are a social based system, there is that time that you might have to wait. So for example, someone who might be seeking mental health care through a psychologist or whatnot, they might have to wait for services for a long period of time unless they access it through the emergency services. So like coming into the emergency department in a crisis, that's when they might actually start having some form of help or assistance that way. So we have something called a forming system. So if a patient came in with a mental health crisis, they can be formed for up to 24 hours, up to 72 hours, depending on the severity. And then they'll have reassessment. And again, if they're admitted, they'll get services that way. And then there's also outpatient services. But in terms of seeing someone private, so for example, if you wanted marriage counseling or if you needed psychotherapy, those things that you would have to pay for those things out of pocket, or if you have additional insurance through your work, then you'd use that type of coverage to receive those services.
Yeah, and Amy, just tagging on to what you said, so in our hospital system, we have publicly available wait times for all different types of surgeries. And so there's a benchmark for each type of surgery. So let's say you're waiting for a hip replacement or a knee replacement, there is a benchmark of, you know, the time that you should be able to get it by. And all of the hospitals have to report these wait times. And if they continue to exceed these wait times a lot, they could lose some of their funding. So there is a financial aspect tied to it as well. But at the same time, that means you can't jump the queue. So just because you know somebody or you've got a lot of money, you can't jump. You have to wait just like everybody else. And that might be a hard thing for Americans to get used to. But we're very used to here in Canada. And I think for the most part, it works. Like there are downsides heads as well, but we're just used to it. And I think the thing about universal healthcare or socialized medicine is that you're more thinking of the collective good. So versus what's good for an individual, you're thinking about what's good for the whole community.
And I do think that's a problem that we have in my country. I feel like the people here that we do struggle with not just looking at ourselves and what we're going to have to sacrifice for the greater good. So in 2016, on the campaign trail, Donald Trump, before he became our president, he mentioned that when people in Canada needed a big operation, when something happens, they come into the United States, and in many cases, because their system is so slow.
A majority of House Democrats have already signed up for socialist health care. By the way, it doesn't work anywhere in the world, just so you understand. It doesn't work. It's good if you don't mind waiting like 5 weeks to see your doctor. They come from socialist countries. Frankly, they come from Canada because they want to use our doctors. They come from all over the world, and we're making it now better. And they want to destroy everything that's been built, all of that great foundation.
You haven't really heard of a lot of people from your country just pouring into America for procedures?
No. I'm sorry that I'm laughing. It's really funny how he can put a spin on something like that. So there are certain procedures that maybe people who are more affluent, or they just don't want to wait, whatever the case may be, would come in and actually have that service done. So that might be very well be like a hip or a knee or whatever. But for the most part, there's Canadians aren't trickling into America for healthcare. If anything, like, oh, I actually remember. No. I actually remember I was, I think I was around 24 weeks pregnant with my twins, and I was visiting my brother in Ohio, and the border guy for the U.S. was like, hey, are you coming in here to have your baby? I was like, oh, hell no, I will go back to Canada well before having my children here. I was like, no. I know that here I'm going to get the same treatment as Beyonce. I don't have to worry about like, oh, you know, I don't have that type of coverage or that type of insurance. I don't have to worry about leaving the hospital with a $50,000 bill, right? Like, mm-hmm. They're not detailing everything I use, like down to the Kleenex. It's just like, okay, so I've paid my taxes. We have how it works in terms of our system is like it's from 30,000 upwards that you start paying larger amounts of taxes on your income. And really, I don't know, like I don't, maybe it's because I'm used to it. I just don't miss it. It's like, oh, there goes that money to the OHIP, the Ontario Health Insurance Plan. But the thing is, I don't have to worry about, you know, receiving care and having to pay a large bill. And some people are okay with that, but for most people, it bankrupts people in the States. We hear about that all the time. Yeah, so no, I don't think there are droves of people, Canadians, flocking to America for healthcare. That's definitely not the case.
And I actually have a story of my uncle-in-law who used to work in the States quite a bit of the time. And he has a history of heart attack in his family. His father passed away of a heart attack in his 40s. So when he was working in the States, he developed chest pain and was trying to drive back over the border, but he couldn't quite make it in time. Mm. And so he ended up having to seek care in the States for something that seemed very much like a heart attack. It turned out it wasn't a heart attack, but in the end, all of the tests that they did and he had to stay overnight, it was somewhere between $30,000 to $40,000 US. Mm-hmm. For everything that he received. And if he had been able to make it over the border, it would have been free. So he just could not make it. He was 30 minutes away from the border and he had to go to the hospital. So I think about that story a lot just to compare the differences between what someone would have paid here versus what someone ended up paying in the States.
So what does that mean as far as comparing what medical professionals make? Because that's another thing that I've heard, that if we were to change to universal healthcare or socialized medicine, that doctors would be poor, that nurses wouldn't make hardly anything. Yeah, I'm telling you, you have no idea all of these things that people believe
in
this country.
Sorry that I'm laughing. It's crazy.
You should laugh.
Okay, so let's dispel the nursing myth first. So what's the average that, so a nurse that comes out of the schooling in the States, a bachelor, so they have their bachelor's degree, 4 years, how much do they make?
Let's say
if they got a full-time job.
Let's say around 50 to 55,000.
Okay, so I would say, so Sarah, you got to do the math for me. So I would say typically starting out here, so we have our collective agreements. Most nurses here are in some form of a union. And I think I should have pulled this up, but I think the going rate now is somewhere between like $33 an hour. Maybe I should pull it up.
Yeah, so for an RN who has a bachelor's degree, they would be starting around $33 Canadian though. So this would be around, let's say, 65,000. Am I right? Around 65,000 Canadian, but I don't know the conversion rate. Maybe that's closer to 50,000 US. So essentially you are making the same amount of money. Mm-hmm. And just to talk
about, it's about the same.
Yeah, just to talk about physicians.
64,350, yeah.
The physicians, it really depends. So if you're a family physician, if you're a general practitioner, I think you would make on the lower end, but you're definitely still making six figures. And if you specialize, you could be making anywhere between 200 to 500K, mm-hmm. I would say. So I don't know what people make in the States, but they're definitely making good money. And I'm sure there are doctors who end up going to the States, but the vast majority of doctors I know who trained in Canada end up staying in Canada.
I was looking at medical school. So I would like to go to medical school. I'm going to take the test that you have to take before applying next spring. And here, if you go out of state, let's say South Carolina, my neighboring state where my parents live, it would be $85,000 a year for medical school. And I was looking that in Canada, the US dollar conversion, I believe, was around, it was less than 12 grand a year.
Really?
Yeah. Now, it was from like 2017, I think. But it was just such a crazy difference. And while we're talking about doctors, do the physicians there work for the government or do they work for themselves?
They work for themselves. So they're sort of like independent contractors. The way that it works is they have privileges at a hospital. So they're not actually employed by the hospital they work at. They have privileges. And I guess it's a good and bad thing. So it gives them more freedom, I suppose, to practice independently. However, from a nurse's perspective, when we're trying to make change, especially quality improvement, and we get them on board, we don't really have a lot to hold them to if they're not willing to work with us in following best practice, evidence-based practice, or whatever I guess the hospital would like them to do. It's more of an ask. We really don't have any authority per se on what they do day to day in their practice.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think there's actually like two funding structures too, right? Like I think there's the pay per service structure model, as well as they get payment from OHIP as well. And I think, I don't know, it's probably the same as it is out there. Physicians do a number of different things. So like most physicians don't just work at the hospital. They might have their own office set up. They might be working as faculty. So, I mean, they're getting a variety of different income sources as well. So yeah, I mean, I think it's just because it's not privatized. They can't make these exorbitant types of fees. They can't set the price. It's kind of a little bit more standardized here that you'll see that pay differential between American physicians versus Canadian.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. One of the things that we learned in nursing school, I think it was like the fundamentals of nursing, that class specifically, we were educated, I mean, semester one, that we have to understand what it's like for our senior citizens, because oftentimes they may not take the medication they need. Let's say they have a history of heart disease, they had a heart attack, they can't afford Eliquis because it's too expensive. And if they were to buy their medication, then their lights were going to have to be turned off or they couldn't pay their utilities. Do you guys hear about that very often? Is that something that you're educated in nursing school?
I can't speak for Amy, but not at all. And right now I work in community health. So we do have the majority of our clients are seniors, and I can't say that that's an issue. So like I said, most of our medications are covered. A lot of our pharmacies will do free delivery. Home services are covered, so not a lot. So a senior, depending on their medical condition, they may be eligible for 1 or 2 hours a day of home care services. So that might mean a PSW, or I guess what you would call a nurse's assistant, would come and do things like bathing, personal care, or it might involve a nurse, or it might involve a rehab provider. So it's all covered, but again, it's not unlimited. So the organization I work with, if you do want more services, you can go the private route and you can pay additional for someone to spend more time with you. But in terms of what you would need basically to stay safe and make sure that you're cared for, it's covered. And if there's any situation where, you know, you can no longer be at home, then you would either need to go to a hospital or I guess a nursing home, but that's a whole other story here. It's difficult and the situation is not good. But I guess just to answer your question, it's not generally something that someone would have to pick between, like I need medication or I need to pay for food, or I need medication or I need to decide if I pay my rent or I keep my lights on. So it's not quite those types of decisions that we have to worry about.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, and just kind of tagging along with what Sarah was saying, like for example, my mom's on Eliquis because she's had supraventricular tachycardia. So with her SVTs that she needed to be cardioverted, she had to be on Eliquis to make sure that she didn't have clots and whatnot, right? Mm-hmm. Her copay is $2.
Wow.
So
do you guys have a cap on your drugs? Like if it's not medication that's covered, for instance, insulin here is outrageous. A lot of type 1 diabetics have a very difficult time affording insulin. And I mean, these are people our age, you know. Mm-hmm. Do you guys have a cap? I mean, I think ours is $300 to $500 a vial for insulin.
You know, it's funny. I have a friend who is a type 1 diabetic and she still has to pay some money out of pocket. But the majority of her supplies, like she's on an insulin pump, her Lancets, I believe most of it's covered by her insurance, but there's still quite a bit that's not. So I think there's definitely some gaps in our system, but I don't know about that much for a vial of insulin. I don't think it would quite cost that much. Amy, I don't know if you have any insights on this.
No, and from my understanding, a lot of Americans actually come to Canada for insulin because their prices are so low. And I think it's also, we also have the two forms. So people can get generic versus the trade names or the brand name. So for example, let's say I needed labetalol, but I couldn't get the brand name. They could then give me the generic form, which might be cheaper. For example, if let's say the brand name, there was a fee to it for $5.99 and then the generic was $1.99. The contents of the medication in terms of chemical composition are exactly the same. It's just the comfort of the buyer, right?
Right.
So, I mean, I don't think we don't have that type of issue here. And I can see where that leads to disparity, right? Like if you are wondering, this drug is this much money, but I have my mortgage to pay, I can see where people can run into those types of situations out there. Whereas the complexity here isn't the same. Like I know I've seen a lot of people actually crowdfunding in the States for, you know, they had an illness or they've had a family member or a loved one die or whatever the case may be, and they're crowdfunding for these resources. And it's very rare that we see crowdfunding here for something like that. Like I think usually we see it for, like, let's say a child has died or maybe both parents have died, we might see funding for to help the child go to school or to help the child have, you know, or to help the families pay for the funeral expenses. But I don't think I've actually seen crowdfunding for drugs here.
Yeah, I don't know if y'all saw the case, but one of the COVID patients who was in the ICU for X amount of days received a bill after he got out of the hospital for over $1 million. Can you believe that?
I don't even know what to say about that.
Well, it just deters people from the healthcare system, right? Like, I mean, healthcare is supposed to be about primary care prevention, right? The whole point of the system is that you enter the system while you're healthy and you're trying to upkeep your health, right? I find that it seems that people seek out care when they're very, very ill in the States, when so many things have gone wrong already. And then they get these exorbitant amount of bills. Like, I think it's a deterrent. People are just like, why would I go if I know I'm going to have to pay all this stuff? Where our system, it's like, we want to keep you healthy. Go see your doctor as many times as you need to, so we can prevent these illnesses, so we can prevent these diseases, so we could treat you accordingly all along the way. And then you don't have to worry about, you know, whether if I go, if I'm going to have this type of bill. Like, I think that's crazy. I think it just adds another level of stress. Like, people who are coming to the hospital are already vulnerable, right? And now you've survived another health issue that you had, and now you have to be worried about whether you can actually afford your home or what you might have to sell off. I think that's ludicrous. I think that's cruel. And here, like, we have patients in the ICU for days and days and days. They're going to go home, and then we'll still give them services if they need help to transition to the community, and they'll never see a bill.
And here, what the main population of people, if you're not in healthcare, if you're not a nurse, whenever the Affordable Care Act was passed, we started with what was called HCAP. So the hospitals would get reimbursement, but the reimbursement is also partially based on patient satisfaction. So people would leave the hospital and they would call the patient and say, hey, on a scale of 1 to 10, I don't know, how pleased were you? Well, if they didn't get their blanket delivered fast enough because the patient next to them was coding, then they would give a poor score. Hospitals don't get the money. And then it's just this crazy cycle. I think we lost Sarah.
Yeah, but I mean, in terms of, like, I think it's how your system's set up. It's set up for a certain type of person, which I think is really fundamentally what the problem is. Like, we really try to have our system set up that it's equitable enough. Like, we're not perfect, right? Like, there are still many challenges with health inequity, mm-hmm. poverty. Like, I put a little post about the social determinants of health, but it's not to the starkly difference as it is in the States, where it's just like, you, like, if you're rich, you're gonna get the best care. If you're poor, you know, them's the breaks. It should be like, you're poor, you still get exceptional care. Like, I think it's just, it's mind-boggling that those are the types of dichotomies that you have mm-hmm. to deal with. And I don't think it should have to be that way, right? And I don't think people should be afraid of this type of a system. I think it's, you have to be looking at it from the standpoint of, what would I want to have my loved one, like, what would I want my loved one to have, right? What would I want my child to receive? And I think if you start thinking of it that way, it'll seem a little bit more different in terms of what you're willing to pay for. And I think, I don't know, it's just, this is all I'm used to. I find it astounding that people will leave the ICU with a million yeah. dollar bill. Like, in my lifetime, if I can make $1 million, I'll be like, yes. Having someone who doesn't have the resources, and now you're going to give them that type of bill. Like, I'd love to know what your suicide rates are out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could only imagine. Like, it's just, well, it's very disheartening.
And I think, going back to when you were saying that the way that your healthcare is organized and set up, it's more about, people feel comfortable going in to get preventative medicine to nip things in the bud before it gets there, right? Until it gets to the point of emergency, or you're so sick that you may not be able to, like, rehabilitate back to your baseline prior. And I think that's probably why in Canada, your lifespan is higher than the United States too, because you actually put the focus on individuals, on their healthcare, and that's what is important to your country.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't think anybody here has a fear of going to their doctor. I'd probably say the reason why one of the reasons we might have higher wait times is because people might use the emergency department as their primary care form of prevention, right? So instead of going to their family doctor and be like, oh, you know, maybe my family doctor lives like 30 minutes away, or, you know, I have this little issue here, I'm going to just go to the emerg. And that's where you see, like, the improper use of the emergency department systems here. And that kind of bogs up the system, right? It's, if you're going to the emergency department, it should be an emergency. Like, there should be a real reason why you're going. And some people might go because, you know, they have the snuffles or whatever the case may be, and they're not using it. But I mean, in that case, that's where we see we have issues with wait time. We have issues with gridlock because the system might not be used as appropriately as it can be. Do I think that people are abusing it? I think that's hard to say. Like, I think people misuse the emergency department sometimes, but I don't know if I would go as far as abuse. I think it's more about educating where is the most appropriate place to receive your care.
Yeah, I see that too. Let me ask you how COVID's doing with your healthcare in Canada. Like, how is the testing going? Are you able to get testing? I know that both of you guys are away from bedside now, but you probably have friends that are still in the midst of it.
So I think testing is relatively easy, and I think Sarah can speak to it. I actually have not had to get a COVID test because I've been pretty isolated at home.
Good for you.
Because I've been doing some work from home. But Sarah, why don't you talk about your experience? I think it was actually pretty easy from my understanding.
Well, I've actually gotten tested twice for COVID. So for the first time, it was back in May. And it was just because my grandmother had recently passed away from COVID. So she was in a long-term care facility. Yeah. And she was actually over 100 years old. And she passed away from COVID. So I just really wanted to make sure I didn't have it before I went to see my parents, because I hadn't seen them for about 2 months. And it was pretty straightforward the first time around. I just went. So all of our COVID testing centers are affiliated with hospitals. So you just have to go to a hospital closest to you. You line up. There's a few that have drive-through, and you just go and get tested. So at the time, it wasn't appointment-based. You would just go line up and get it done. And it was maybe 15 minutes start to finish. So it was pretty quick. You know, you go in, you show your health card, you get registered. They take you to like a triage bay area. You get your swab done and they tell you that either they'll call you or you can check your results online. And again, I think one of the things that our government made very clear from the start is that even if you didn't have OHIP, if you were a refugee, if you were illegal in Canada, they encouraged you to go get testing because they didn't want that to be a deterrent and for people to potentially spread COVID if they didn't have, you know, if they didn't have the right documentation or papers. The second time around, I ended up going with my entire family. So my husband and I and our two kids, because my son had a runny nose. And at the time, the schools were saying that if you had any symptoms of COVID, even if it was one symptom, that you had to go get tested or you had to stay at home for 2 weeks. So the second time around was a little bit of a gong show because we lined up for 2.5 hours. And this was us getting to the hospital first thing in the morning. I had chairs, I had snacks, I had, you know, everything just to keep everyone occupied. So it still took 2.5 hours, which apparently was not that bad at the time. And now our system has moved to appointment based. So you have to have an appointment because they don't want people lining up anymore, which makes sense.
Yeah.
And, you know, it has varied. So at some point it was like only healthcare workers could get tested. And then when things kind of, when the numbers went down, it was like, okay, anybody can get tested. Now I think you have to either have symptoms or be in a high-risk group or be a healthcare worker. But regardless, it's still free for everybody and it's accessible. And I think that's one of the great things about it. And they've actually just approved a saliva-based test for use in high-risk environments. So long-term care, that's been approved now recently. So I think that we're coming a long way. And I know in the States, there are drive-throughs that you can do with like drugstores and it comes back in half an hour. We don't have anything like that. The turnaround time right now, I think is probably 24 to 48 hours.
Yeah, hours actually, that's a rumor. It takes a couple days for the drive-thrus. And so you've been tested. So you know how far they have to go back. The drive-thru, they hand the swab to the person. Tell me who, I've been tested once. Tell me who's going to actually put it in the appropriate area at the nasopharyngeal. Oh, get out of here.
You have to touch brain and it has I to know. Burn.
Yeah.
That lucky like, Amy.
Like honestly, I attended a training because at some point I was supposed to do it, and they're like, even after you advance to the very back, you need to like count to 10, and they're like, you make sure
and
you count
it.
To 10, yeah. And spin it, and then do the same thing on the other side. I can't imagine anybody going more than a few inches who's expected to do it themselves.
Well, then how do you even have appropriate numbers out there? Like, I mean,
I don't think we do.
It's not showing a clear, accurate picture of what is actually happening. If, like, I could tell you, I'm telling you right now, if they gave me the swab, I'd be like,
"Yeah, me too."
Just like on the outsides, and no, it's not an MRSA swab. Like, it's a freaking COVID swab that has to go really far back,
right? That's because you want to get where the colonization of the RNA is.
Oh
yeah.
No.
Well,
I'm so sorry.
it's okay. It's just a little crazy here. But thank you both for coming on here and being a part in educating us. I really, really appreciate all of your time.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Yeah, you're welcome. You two are both a delight. So
you were too. It was fun.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. And as always, don't forget to go follow First Do No Harm podcast on Instagram, Facebook, on Twitter. Enjoy yourself. And I look forward to talking to you again within the next week.
Be safe.